Live. Oh, for Pete's sake.
Whose stomach was that?
Yours!
It was not mine!
You're here no, with it your wasn't. Mouth
was it yours?
Open.
It wasn't mine. Yeah, see?
Live from Petonia, New Zealand, this is the Cinematica Podcast, your weekly guide to what's on at the movies. You can find this and other episodes of the show at cinematica.co.nz. Welcome everybody to the latest episode of Cinematica, your favourite roundup of cinema news and reviews, helping you choose what to see next when you go to the movies. I'm Dan Slevin, and here with me in the Cinematica studio is...
Simon Waring.
And Kaylee Carruthers.
Every week, all three of us are here to review the latest releases. We're going to talk to interesting people about what they've been watching, and we keep a close eye on what's happening around the world, films and stories that we're all looking forward to. In today's show, Kaylee is all about the cute animals this week. Penguins, lions, tigers, and there's a few cute humans too. I get vertigo watching Tower Heist. Simon tells us about another Best Actress Oscar contender, Glenn Close in Albert Nobbs. All of that and more in this week's edition of Cinematica. But first, some feedback and follow-up from previous shows. Kaylee, what's in the mailbag today?
I feel like we need mailbag news now, but there would be an overlap. It would be too much. Lewis Bostock, who is a, he's a pretty...
He's quite a well-known social media film buff,
he's a
isn't
social
he?
Media yep. superstar. I became Twitter friends with him during the festival in 2010. He said, "Love the podcast, guys. My two-word review of Tintin is shallow spectacle."
Oh,
bit hard.
Yeah,
I loved it.
Everyone has their own opinion.
But how can it be shallow? It was in 3D.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe the story.
Maybe he only saw it in 2D. Maybe that's it. Yeah.
Maybe. And on Facebook, we had a nice little string of comments. Andrew Cousins, he actually works for Mad Men, and he was commenting on our Best of 2011 episode.
It's kind of scary how many industry people are actually listening to this.
But isn't that the coolest? I mean, honestly, for a distributor named Mad Men, when you meet them, it's kind of like you want to see these crazy guys. But
tentacles.
You know what? Yeah, but they're not. They're just like us. They're just kind of normal. But you want these Mad Men. You want Mad Men. Come on. But they're not.
Or Don Draper. That'd be good. He said... Kaylee has excellent taste. Thank you. I know.
What's that about?
Oh, no.
Kaylee has excellent taste. Tomboy is in my top 10 of the year, too. Oh, and Cat in Paris is out on DVD. Came out December 1st via Mad Men Entertainment New Zealand.
Just a subtle plug.
There's a link on the Facebook page. And also, follow-up, La Quattro Volte will not be released on DVD here, sadly. Would have been through Mad Men, too. So
I wonder what that maybe it's because they realized that they would only sell one copy to me.
I'd buy one too, Andrew. Come on.
Yeah.
Come on, man. Pick
okay.
it up.
Okay. Mad Men.
Yeah, it looks
Be
like it's
come on.
Yep. And come along.
Come on, bring
together.
It.
Come on. I know we've had a bit of a break and the sun's shining outside. Yeah. Let's keep it together.
We're all pretty relaxed.
We are.
Professionalism. Yep.
Professional.
So what have people been watching at the movies the last few days? I know that this is the first day of proper sunshine we've had in ages, so I'm sure everybody was at the movies the last few days.
Yes, and it was a long weekend as well, so what better thing to do than go to the movies? So, number 5, The Iron Lady, which jumped from 23 last week to number 5 this week. Very impressive, I have to say.
It's the big mover.
Number 4, which we'll be reviewing shortly, is Happy Feet 2. Number 3 is Mission Impossible, down from 1 last week. Number 2, Alvin and the Chipmunks Chipwrecked, stays at number 2.
I'm staggered by that.
Was everything else sold out?
Surely some mistake. It's all like that's
was
a typo.
Was everything else sold out?
It's a school holidays. Go for it.
No, I just think, well, if that's a result of the school holidays, then I think that we need educational reform, don't we?
But it does get better because The Adventures of Tintin comes in at number 1. It doesn't specify 3D or 2D, so I guess it's just combined.
Oh, I could get that for you.
Do we really want to know?
No.
I think it'd be quite heavily weighted. Like probably 80% of that box office would be.
So is that the Avatar effect? You think that lots of people going because it's the big event of the Christmas holidays?
Yeah, I do. Yep.
And do you think that there's an element of the fact that it's a Wingnut local Peter Jackson thing, that there's this that people are being supportive of Sir Peter?
I think so. I think that, you know, there's always that local sort of support, but probably it's still, you know, comparable to how it's opened, you know,
worldwide.
Per capita, worldwide. Right. But yeah, I mean, well, certainly in Europe. I'm not sure about the figures in the US and how it's worked.
I think
there.
It's still early days in the US, mm. isn't it? But mm. There's certainly the next one has already got its green light, so we expect to see a little bit more of that in a couple of years' time. Mm. No, Peter's got to finish all the Hobbit, hasn't he? So it's going to be years before they even start.
He's got people.
I'll be old and grey.
But I managed to, because I didn't see Tintin for a while. I took the kids over the holidays, and I was just blown away by it. I thought it was just superb, and the way that it blended, you know, those two to three sort of stories.
So you saw it with an audience of civilians rather than...
Yeah.
I saw it at the opening of the embassy, the new screens at the embassy, and so there were a lot of movie people, a sort of very knowing crowd, you know, sit back and go, yes, that's very interesting.
Mm. Rather you saw than it twice, then?
I have seen it twice, yeah. Yeah.
Well, the whole group that I was with absolutely adored it. And then we had young children right through to sort of, you know, grandparents. It was great.
Well, let's have a look now at another animated 3D spectacle. And we'll have a serious, academically decent discussion about... Oh.
Wow.
Take your little furball and fluff off.
You'll be apologizing, or I'm gonna tear you a new nostril.
The entire population is trapped by huge walls of ice and snow.
What can he do? He's just an ordinary penguin.
Uh-oh.
That's not healthy.
Okay, so we finally got there in the end. Happy Feet 2, Kaylee.
Oh, I've been looking forward to this since the trailer started screening. I loved Happy Feet 1.
Yeah.
I loved it. Everyone looks at me funny. I think it's fantastic. So, Happy Feet 2. If you haven't seen Happy Feet 1, you might be a bit confused about what's going on, but really it's an all-singing, all-dancing penguin extraordinaire. It's fantastic.
With one puffin.
With one puffin. A poofin?
Yes. A what?
Sven the Proven.
Oh, you really had, yeah, you really did have to.
You're
be
in character
there for
today.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's good.
Mm. So in Happy Feet 2, Mumble's son Eric is struggling to realize his talents in the Emperor Penguin world. Meanwhile, Mumble and his family and friends discover a new threat to their home, one that will take everyone working together to save them. Which is actually a gigantic iceberg that moves and traps them.
It's all very environmental, isn't it?
It is, but not as environmental as the first one I found.
No, my memory of the first one was that it was cute, it was cute, it was cute, it was cute, and then the final scene was like, oh my God, it would have sent children screaming from the theatres, that first one, because it just turned very, very ugly. And they have, I think, moderated the shifts in tone in this one. It is just kind of nuts all the way through, isn't it? It's bonkers.
It is.
Yeah.
Wonderful, wonderful bonkers. And there's some great...
Without the wonderful, wonderful, but yeah.
Oh, that's your opinion, Dan. I believe I'm leading this review.
Yeah, yep. Go for it. Keep going.
I really enjoyed it, and there's some great voice talents in it as well. Many who came back from the first film, so that was good.
Yep. Could you tell Matt Damon and the other one apart? What's his name? Brad Pitt?
Bradley. Brad.
It was actually a bit difficult to tell their voices apart. They have very similar voices. But actually, that whole side story I kind of had issues with. It was a bit...
It was very thematic.
Yeah, it was like... Yeah, it definitely reflected the theme.
But in the history of animated animals, I think they've got to Krill, then they're running out, aren't they? They're running out of animals to turn into cutesy movie characters.
But it was like, it was like this strange odd couple / like unrequited love on the side of Matt Damon thing. It was a bit much.
And I think it was symptomatic for me of how bananas the whole thing was, to be honest.
But I loved it, and we're also reviewing We Bought a Zoo, and Happy Feet 2 and We Bought a Zoo are like competing for the most tears that I shed this episode. I cried, like...
You cried at Happy Face?
I cried. Oh, my God, when Gloria was, like, singing and little Eric was... Oh, my God, I was, like, bawling my eyes out. So was Ian.
Oh, well, that's all right, then.
It's like a collective thing, isn't it? I think once one person goes, you all sort of go, you just start, you know...
Oh, and maybe. Happy... Like, just... Oh, they're, or like...
Maybe it wasn't singing. With... You know, maybe he was upset about something else. I don't know.
It's being popcorn. Dragged to,
well, popcorn to Happy Feet too. Or something.
Maybe it was out of focus. That would make him cry.
Yeah, yeah.
It no, would. It was digital. It was 3D, so it could right. be out of, yep. Well, I guess I could be if they tried real hard. but I loved it.
Okay. So your two words?
I have more than two words.
Oh, darn.
Bah. Because I had to get all punny on it. Mm-hmm. It's 2012, first episode of 2012.
Yeah.
And I have to say Happy Feet 2 hits the right notes.
Okay, right notes, right notes. I think we can get that. Well, I think we'll allow that. My two words, very strange. It was nuts.
It was.
It was because it's written in Australia. It's written and made in Australia, and it just seemed to me that everybody involved in it went, well, we hit a home run with the first one. They're going to give us a whole lot of money to make the next one. What are we going to do?
And
they
more just songs.
And they went. For it went for it all. Went and is Robin Williams playing two characters?
I think he's playing two, but in the first he played three or four.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I wonder if he gets paid twice.
Per character, yeah.
Yeah. Mm. Nice work if you can get it. All right, we've had our two words. Simon, you haven't quite made it to Happy Feet 2, but on the basis of Kaylee's review, I'm sure you will be there tonight.
I'll rush down there with the kids, and it's on our list to see over the holidays.
Fantastic.
No finger marks on the knife blades, please.
You don't have to be anything but who you are. Look at how you've survived all these years. You've worked hard and you've saved your money.
You've it all stashed under the mattress, is it, Mr. Knobs?
I've been thinking I might purchase a little shop. A woman could serve at the counter.
You're not thinking of taking a wife.
Who's the lucky lady?
I was wondering if you would come out for a walk.
Are you asking me to walk out with you?
And that, ladies and gentlemen, is an extract from Albert Nobbs, an unpromising title if ever I came across one. Glenn Close. And Simon, you went to see that for us. What did you think of it?
It's a very interesting film. I mean, Glenn Close, this is based on the stage show, which has been running for a while, I think. It's been very popular.
Yeah, and she's been wanting to make this film for a long time, hasn't she?
Mm. Yeah. And, I mean, she produces it. It's all her sort of grunt put into the film. And she, her role in the film is quite, you know, amazing to watch. I found it quite a fascinating film. I mean, you know, it's a period piece, and she plays this butler who's, you know, a woman playing a man who's living in this kind of oppressed sort of world the whole time. You know, she's constantly sort of in fear of being found out. I just thought it was fascinating, a fascinating reminder in a way about how limited opportunity was for women back in that day. So I think it's a very worthy film, and she, her performance stands out like anything in that film. It's quite amazing.
Yeah, it's extraordinary, isn't it, Kaylee?
Yeah, I thought that Glenn Close's performance was wonderful. And it's a really interesting story. It wasn't tied up. I think the ending wasn't really tied up for me. It ended on a kind of...
It's not very satisfying, is it, that ending? You know that... I don't really want to spoil anything, but you sort of... you can. It sets a tone at the beginning, and you sort of know that this is not going to end well. And yet they somehow had to provide some redemption at the end. Like, I'd be interested to know whether the novel or the play that it's based on ends in a similar fashion, because I think that there's a certain amount of it's so desolate, we can't send audiences out, we've got to give them something. But it didn't necessarily ring true.
Yeah, and I found that I could really tell that it was adapted from a stage play, because it didn't have that same subtlety that a film usually has. You know, it's right there, and you see it, and it's acted out, and it's physically acted out for you, which was very enjoyable. The major criticism I have is the camera work was a bit shoddy at times. There was something off with
made
with
a little
camera.
Bit fast, perhaps, but very, very low budget for a sort of a normal sort of clean close movie, I would imagine. You know, it's a lot of money put into it was hers. The director, Rodrigo Garcia, was probably best known for The Good Girl, is it? Where I'm just having a quick look. He made a film called Mother and Child. Hmm. Earlier on this year, he makes a lot of television, which is, you know, I think a sign that he works fast. It didn't seem to have a particularly strong sort of visual. I think a lot of the angles.
Very enclosed.
Yes, and I think a lot of the exterior angles were chosen so that they didn't see modern Dublin, sort of, you know, they could only pan so far across the beach.
But it's also the sense of entrapment. And that's the way that it's filmed in a way. Everything's very kind of tight, and the rooms are very small, and there's a sense of awkwardness, which sort of prevails throughout the whole film.
Which is great, and the set is beautifully done. It's more that there's, I think there's like two or three whip pans in it, but the camera like kind of, it pans, and then either the next shot's really awkward, or the camera hits the wall and jiggles a bit, and you're like, wait a second.
It seemed to me that there were quite a few interesting political aspects in the film, not just the gender issues, but also class.
Absolutely. I mean, the young couple trying to sort of make a break for a better life.
And realizing that it was America or nothing, really, you know, that there was going to be nothing there for them. And also, because Albert Nobbs works in a posh Dublin hotel that seems to be frequented mostly by the British gentry having dirty weekends, you know, that they could go to Dublin, go to Ireland and behave badly, but get up to all sorts of mischief without the repercussions that they would have if they were doing that at home. And so I think that sort of tourism, sexual tourism aspect of it was kind of interesting as well. There's a character in it called Joe Macken, who is, I guess, Albert's antagonist in the film. He's the other guy competing for Mia Wasikowska's love. He interests me because I've seen him in quite a few things now. Actually, not quite a few things, three things. And every single time I've seen him, I've gone, who are you?
Yeah.
Who
yeah.
are you? And then I've gone to look him up and I've gone, oh, right, you were that. You know, he was the...
You're Kick-Ass.
You're the guy from Kick-Ass. Exactly. But I watched Nowhere Boy, the John Lennon film, and I did exactly the same thing. I'm going, I should know you from somewhere, and had to look it up. And I go, oh, right, you're the guy from Kick-Ass. Now, I'm not saying he's particularly good, but there is something about him that means that he's able to sort of bounce between all of these different genres and all of these different worlds. And I think we'll be seeing a lot more of him. Aaron Johnson.
He covers off that role of being the charming one moment and then quite sort of brutal and violent.
Yeah, exactly.
And
yep. And it's a very tough thing to do because for a lot of the film you do, we're giving probably a few too many spoilers away here probably, but you do sort of think that he's going to be a more positive influence on the film than he turns out to be. And so we've all seen The Iron Lady as well. We've all seen Meryl Streep.
And how would they compare?
Yeah, I'm just wondering if you were to pick who, because it's between these two, isn't it, for the Oscar? There's nobody else.
Yeah, might be a bit soon for that. Might be something that comes out in the next month or two.
I'd be very surprised if it comes down to anybody else but these two. But he's looking at the whiteboard.
Young adult.
No. Charlize Theron. Yeah. Okay. All right. So maybe we'll hold off.
Just early indicators here. You know.
Okay. We're handicapping the race. I still think that Meryl's way out in front, actually. I just felt that Glenn Close, for all of her technical performance in Albert Nobbs, there was something about, you know how Glenn Close has made an entire career out of playing high status, and this is the first time I've ever seen her play low status, and it just didn't quite work for me 100%.
I don't know. This whole role that she plays is about being kind of withdrawn and not giving anything away emotionally, physically.
Yep.
And that must be quite that's a very tough role to sort of convey.
I think
she does quite a good job of that. And whereas Streep, I don't know, maybe it's just that you see too much of Streep doing what she does.
Right,
and
maybe.
Whereas Glenn Close, you know, I thought that was quite a new and interesting way to see her on the screen. I wouldn't be surprised, you know. I wouldn't be surprised.
All right, I'd felt that character was, I felt the reason why it was hard to get into the film is because she was so closed off and so giving nothing away of herself that it meant that it was hard for me to actually get into the story.
But that's the price that she pays.
I know. Yeah. Exactly. And that's the tragedy.
And that's why when she looks at the other sort of
character,
you know, the couple, she's just so envious and amazed that this world exists.
Yeah. I think we could talk about Albert Nobbs for an entire show, couldn't we? And I think that says something about the caliber of film that it is. Unfortunately, we are going to have to move on because they're busy Christmas period and what have you. But two words, Simon.
Oscar worthy.
Ooh.
Because I loved Happy Feet 2 so much this week, I'm going to say that Albert Nobbs is a close second.
Okay. My two words for Albert Nobbs, pretty ballsy.
Ha ha!
So now we haven't got any audio for the next two because I think they're probably only playing in Wellington, so we'll just sort of mention that they're on, I guess, and I'm not sure how far around the country these are going to get. So the first Beautiful Thing is an Italian film that was, I think it was the opening night film in the Italian Film Festival here in Wellington, and that's playing at the Paramount here. I actually should have read the summary of it before I went to see it again the other day, and you know, the first opening credits rolled up and I went, oh, I've seen this already, had to go. So a bit of a wasted afternoon there, but it is a very charming Italian romance, very unusual. So if you do sort of want something Italian, feel like something continental, the first Beautiful Thing is out there. Completely different, my two words for that, standard romance. Completely different to that, also playing at the Paramount in Wellington, and I imagine at a couple of other locations around the country. Viva Riva. What do you know about that, Simon? Were you offered that here?
No, I wasn't. It's a foodies film, isn't it? Like, it's... No.
I'm thinking of
something with tapas in it.
Viva Riva is actually the first major feature film to come out of the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Used to be known as Zaire, back when Muhammad Ali was fighting there in the 70s. And it is, I thought it was a bit over the top, actually. I thought it's extremely violent. It's about a character called Riva who has stolen a whole lot of barrels of petrol from Angola, imported them into Kinshasa. Apparently the petrol shortages are just amazing, so he could charge enormous amounts of money for these. But he gets embroiled with a couple of rival gangs who are also after the petrol, and it becomes an incredibly violent... I guess it's like an African Scarface, you know, in terms of...
tapas or food in
it. No tapas, no food in it at all. No, you're wrong.
The wild stab in the dark.
good guess. Good guess, Simon. While I could respect it as an example of a film industry growing, a film industry blooming where you wouldn't expect one, and it is very glossy, very well put together, very tight, and lots of action, but it is very, very nasty. And I sort of thought, oh, well, this is a bit over the top. And then I read an article in the New York Times this morning about Kinshasa, where even people in the police force can only afford to feed their kids once every 2 days because the shortages are so extraordinary. So I've given the link to Kaylee so she can put the link to the story in the show notes, because I think it's definitely worth reading. And so maybe Viva Riva might actually be a bit more of a documentary than I gave it credit for.
Maybe.
Mm. But my two-word review for it is extremely violent. I actually did have to turn away on a few occasions, and I'm pretty rugged when it comes to that sort of stuff. But no,
it's true. Couldn't. He wears his adventure vest to the cinema.
Yeah, and I mean,
it's the Bear Grylls of cinema in Wellington.
it's hard work.
It is.
It's not easy being me. And so that's Viva Riva. Neither of you guys have seen it.
I do know it was at the festival, but I did not see it.
Right. So, but it is playing. It'll probably be a limited release, I think, amongst all of the other high profile stuff that's around. Time for some news.
Thank you, Dan.
You're welcome, Kaylee.
Just after Christmas, Roger Ebert wrote an excellent assessment of why, in his opinion, movie attendances are dropping, and he puts the blame fairly and squarely on exhibition. Ticket prices, including 3D surcharges, because I can speak English, candy bar prices, poor selection of titles, poor screening conditions. Oh my gosh. What do you think? What are your experiences going to the cinema? Let us know at cinematica.co.nz or on Twitter at cinematicacast.
Indeed. And the link to the Roger Ebert article, which has got a huge amount of traffic after Christmas. It came out on the 28th, I think, and I think it's had over 500,000 hits on this, just this one sort of manifesto about why, because Hollywood is terrified at the moment because they're really struggling box office wise, and one of the reasons is that there was no Avatar this year, no Lord of the Rings, so there was going to be a lull anyway. But he really does put the boot into exhibition, and I think one of the reasons for that is that in the US they don't have the same culture that we have here of neighborhood cinemas, independent
suburban
neighborhood cinemas, coffee and couches cinemas, and I think that that it's very, you know, the standards of presentation are really generally pretty high in New Zealand. I think that people tend to care a great deal about getting things in focus and getting sound right and not playing things through busted ass speakers and what have you. So I think that it would be fair to say that in New Zealand we haven't experienced the downturn that they have in the States, even though there'll be a lot of people who are disappointed at how long they have to wait for titles and what have you. But people are still going, aren't they, Simon?
They are, and I think the big issue, you touched on it there, the big issue for New Zealand is more about how things are released and the timing of it, you know, and keeping the momentum going so that it's very consistent. Instead of having like peaks and troughs, which is sometimes the case.
Yeah.
But, you know, I take it, I mean, I look at that and I kind of think in a way that it's a bit harsh because it's not all down to the exhibitors. It's also down to the quality of the content that's coming through and what you've got to work with. And a lot of those places as well, their primary focus often is more about the popcorn and the Coke that they sell. And so what's that? What type of model is that?
Yep.
When it should be all about the content and what's on the screen.
Totally. Well, there are too many cinemas that really consider themselves to be candy bars that show pictures, as opposed to cinemas where the product is an extra.
And it's funny. I mean, I've been to some cinemas in the US, and they're massive. You know, the number of screens they've got, and you walk in there, and there's nobody there. So you go to a film, you can walk out, and you can just go to another film if you want. I mean, you know, I'm not encouraging that sort of thing, but I'm just saying that there's no personal sort of contact.
Yeah, and no relationship being built. No, I would say that the other reason, and I think Ebert alludes to this as well, is another reason why people are in the States maybe are deserting movie theaters, and that is because of the quality of the people they're sitting next to, and audiences are behaving badly, you know. And I think that I've always wondered what came first, audiences being treated like cattle or behaving badly so that they get treated like cattle, you know.
Wow, I remember going to my stop out soccer bun fight as a, you know, 7-year-old, and it wasn't very nice. It was pretty rowdy. It was, you know, it's gone back a few years now. I think there's always been an element of kind of
well, people will tell you about rolling Jaffers down the aisles when they were at the Saturday morning flicks. So
it's nostalgia.
Maybe, yeah. So and if they'd had laser pointers in the 1940s when you were going to the movies for the first time.
Oh, yes, in the 1940s. Thank you very much.
they would have been waving them around at the screen, I'm sure. So has behaviour improved or not improved? Has it deteriorated? Then maybe we should find a really old person to...
What, I'm born in the 1940s. I'm not old enough for you.
Well, you know, I'm sure there will be somebody, maybe Richard Weatherly. Maybe we could get Richard Weatherly in, and he can tell us what it was like in his day. Anyway, give us some feedback about why you think it's still worth going to the movies and watching stuff on the big screen, or what might be is holding you back from going more often. That would be interesting, I think. So, Kaylee, next piece of news.
Next piece of news. More sequel news, or remake, I should say, not sequel. You may have seen the French thriller Crime d'amour. My French is...
Or crime.
Crimes of love. I apologize to my French teacher. Kirsten Scott Thomas and Ludivine Sagnier in a twisty psychological thriller that kept audiences guessing and did huge box office in France. And did not too bad here as well. Brian De Palma has signed on to direct the inevitable Hollywood remake. And Rachel McAdams and Noomi Rapace will star. What other Euroflix do you want to see remade this year? What would you like to see without subtitles?
Yeah, there are some films that you watch the French versions and you just go, nah, this has got to be. This will get made by Hollywood. It would have to be because, you know, they're ready-made fodder. And as we're finding with the Dragon Tattoo films, you know, lots of American audiences don't really want to read. You know, they don't want to read subtitles, so they will wait. Mm-hmm. So, anything we saw last year that you thought was going to get I'm actually putting this out to our audience, mm-hmm. actually, rather than just us coming up with all the answers. But I'm sure that there are quite a few that we saw that.
Tell No One. Was it ever remade into an American version or an English version?
I don't think it was, but it was based on an American book, I think, originally. Tell No One.
A cracker of a film.
Yep. And I'm sure there are lots of films like that. There was one in the festival about the – you'll remember what this one was, Kaylee. I can't remember what it was called. But it was about the nurse whose wife is kidnapped. He witnesses a crime and the guy who's been shot, who's been nursing, busts out of the hospital, and it all happens in a – damn, I wish I could remember what that
really
was called.
It sounds really exciting, but it's not bringing up anything.
No,
that wasn't a remake with Crow.
No, but the Crow – but there is that's a great example of a film that was – that was remade. This is going to bug me now. We're going to have to put
it out when you think of it in the show.
Yeah, okay.
Just be like Tourette's.
I've got my screen in front of me. I might just be going through the festival website while we're talking.
And the latest in the long roundup of pre-Oscar smoke signals is the Producers Guild of America Top 10. The only surprise from the other lists we've seen so far is the inclusion of the female-skewed comedy Bridesmaids.
If that gets an Academy Award nomination for Best Picture, I'm going to...
What are you going to do?
What? Become what? A book reviewer.
A book reviewer.
I might just give up on cinema.
All right. Well, if that's so, then we have an opening here at Cinematica.
Yeah. That's Oscar night. Oscar night's taking on a bit of more pressure.
I didn't promise to eat anything inedible.
Yeah.
So if you're free on Tuesday nights, starting in February, please let us know.
When Bridesmaids picks up 7 Oscars.
Yes. Continuing
on. I'm crying on the inside.
At Movie City News, David Poland handicaps the eventual Oscar nominees in Reconcile will be only 7. These 7 being The Artist, The Descendants, Hugo, War Horse, The Help, Midnight in Paris, and Moneyball, only 2 of which have been seen in New Zealand thus far.
Which I think is really interesting, isn't it? That of those high profile Oscar contenders, only, you know, all throughout all of 2011, only 2 got released here, and you know the rest of them are all being squeezed into a very tight period over the next couple of months. Hugo's in 2 or 3 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
War Horse is next week.
Moneyball. What have we got? Have we got a date for Moneyball?
We do. 16th of Feb.
Right. So it is. It's just going to go nuts, isn't it, for the next couple of months with all of these great films.
Very busy time.
Yeah. So we'll keep an eye on that.
Yes, and we'll put a link to that in the show notes as well.
To that list, yeah.
Yes. Continuing on with our news, we have a lot of news today. Oh, man.
Sorry.
And the French critics have made some interesting selections for their Best of the Year roundups. A website has combined the lists of 14 top French movie publications and blogs, including Premiere and Cahiers du Cinéma, and turned it into a French top 15. Ooh. At the top is Tree of Life, which Dan will be very happy about.
I was very disappointed to know that it wasn't in that David Poland top 7 Academy Award nominees. If it doesn't get an Academy Award, I'm not going to make any promises.
I'll eat my shoe.
I'm not going to make any rash promises, but I'll be very disappointed.
Oh, and the list also features The Adventures of Tintin, Drive, and Melancholia. Top French film in the list is House of Pleasures, about a turn of the 19th century Parisian brothel, which was described as batshit crazy by one New York critic.
And I haven't seen that on anybody's release list here in New Zealand. I expect that at some point, either during the showcase or the New Zealand Film Festival in July, we'll get to see that one, House of Pleasures. I've read a few articles about it, and it does seem to be like quite nuts. Mm-hmm. In a really good way, I think, or in a very dark way, certainly.
Not in a happy feet way.
No, different kind of nuts.
Mm, okay. No. But speaking of totally nuts, For those of us out there who love the combination of film, real life, and science, it has taken 50 years, but Alfred Hitchcock's most enduring whodunit appears to have finally been solved. Speaking of the movie, The Birds. Scientists at Louisiana State University claim to have discovered why thousands of seagulls began killing themselves along the coast of Northern California in the summer of 1961. The mysterious avian deaths, which inspired the film The Birds, many birds flew kamikaze style into houses along the Monterey Bay shore south of San Francisco. And it turns out that these marine biologists, after conducting many postmortems, have decided that the birds were poisoned and just went batshit crazy.
So you're talking like LSD, maybe?
If they were experimented on.
Maybe, maybe they were poisoned en masse to get rid of all the seagulls? I'm not sure. But there will be a link to that article in the show notes. That was from the Independent, but I thought that was a great newsworthy story today.
The Cinematica podcast, entertaining and educational, ladies and gentlemen.
Yes.
And I didn't know that The Birds was a documentary. That's fascinating.
Well, it's not a documentary.
Well,
but it's inspired by true events, which may have also been reflected in Birdemic as well, if anyone saw that, which I did.
And that is the end of the news. Will we run out finally?
Yes. Well, the extra news will be on our website today.
Awesome. All right, back to the reviews.
Morning, Mr. Shaw. Everything's set for your dinner party.
The guy stole from everyone who works in your building.
They're going to get our money.
It's all gone.
I'm thinking of becoming a male prostitute.
I think I might have a better idea.
So you're saying you want to rob $20 million from Arthur Shaw's penthouse apartment?
Yes. You're going to go to jail.
Yes.
You're going to die. Probably
yes.
Both.
Yeah. Yes. Join me.
I'm in.
Well, now we're undefeatable, aren't we?
And that is Tower Heist, which is a new film starring Ben Stiller and Eddie Murphy. Eddie Murphy's a producer on this film, and it's made by that titan of the art house, Brett Ratner.
And of inappropriate comments as well.
Totally inappropriate comments, and I think he made the first... He made an X-Men film, but also the Rush Hour franchise. That was probably what made Brett Ratner famous. And Bad Boys, did he do one of those bad boys? I know. That's the sort of caliber of director we're talking about here. It's quite a star-filled ensemble piece. As I say, Ben Stiller, Eddie Murphy, Casey Affleck is in it as well. Alan Alda plays the villain. And it's kind of one of those plucked from the headlines kind of stories. It's a beautiful, palatial, opulent apartment building in the middle of New York where only the best of the best, the richest of the rich, get to live. And in the penthouse is Wall Street banker played by Alan Alda, who's the hero to all of the people who work below stairs. And he has invested all of their pension money along with all of his other clients. And it turns out he's a crook and has been arrested by the feds for ripping everybody off. And of course, everybody who works in the building, led by Ben Stiller, they've lost their pensions, they've lost their futures, they've lost their life savings. And so they decide to break into his apartment and empty out all the cash that they think he has hidden away for a rainy day there. And because they know the building, of course, they know the security, they can do this. What they've never done before is they've never actually stolen anything. So they need to find a crook who can actually help them do that. And they find Eddie Murphy, who they bail out of jail in order to teach them how to be nefarious criminals. And, well, is it any good is the question that you're about to ask me. And I have to say it's not horrible. Despite the build-up that I've just given it, it actually works better as, like, the dramatic stuff where they find out that they've been ripped off. That works quite well. You know, you really feel for these people and you can understand why they would want to wreak their revenge. Alan Alda is brilliant and slimy as the villain, and you can totally imagine how he would be able to win people's trust and then betray them. Ben Stiller, his usual sort of... A lot of the usual annoyances, apart from Eddie Murphy, who we'll come to in a minute, a lot of the usual annoyances of those characters, of those actors, is dialed back a wee bit. And it's more than watchable. And some of the people like Matthew Broderick and Casey Affleck and Tia Leone, who I'm a big fan of, are actually pretty good in this. And I didn't hate this film at all. And even Eddie Murphy was kind of watchable for the times that he was on the screen. So, yeah, you're looking at me as if I've lost the plot completely here and I've just thrown all of my critical faculties out the window, but I'm going to say, yeah, I quite liked it.
Good work.
Congratulations, Dan.
Yeah.
Congratulations on sitting through Tower Heist.
I should retire now. and so I'm the only one at the table who's actually seen it. Is that right?
Yeah, well, I'm not a Brett Ratner fan. I really, really dislike Casey Affleck. I just do not like him.
Really? Okay.
And yeah, Ben Stiller.
Why? What's your Casey problem?
Oh, it's just...
He's got a high, squeaky voice.
Leave him alone. He's good.
He's just so irritating. And there's this show... I have to segue to actually tell you why I dislike Casey Affleck. There's this TV show that was made out of Vancouver.
Out of plasticine? What?
No, it was in MTV. And it was called For Real, and they took celebrities into third world countries or developing countries and introduced them to leaders who were creating positive change. And Casey Affleck was in one of these episodes. Mm-hmm. And he was just so whiny and stupid and naive and irritating. And I wanted to punch him in the face because I'm like, I'm sorry, look what is wrong with you?
Can't argue with that. No, that's a strong response, and I can imagine that would color his career forever in your eyes.
And then
he'll
also
never bounce back from that.
No, and then I also walked out of The Killer Inside Me because I think that was the most awful thing I've ever seen.
Yeah, Killer Inside Me. Yeah, no, I agree with you. That was a very difficult film, but I have seen Casey Affleck be good in quite a few things. In The Assassination of
Jesse James
by the coward Robert Ford. Mm. I thought he was really good in that.
He was good in that.
And what was the first one that was directed by his brother where he plays the private eye?
Don't know.
Another one. I really need to get better notes. I really need to prepare better for these shows. Yes. But, you know, people will know what I'm talking about. I thought he was pretty good in that too. So he does actually do some acting in this film, which is, and as Matthew Broderick does, and as Ben Stiller actually attempts to. So, you know, in some ways, it's not as out there, as wacky a comedy as perhaps the trailer would and the poster would have you believe, and the cast would have you believe. It's got a little bit of grit to it. Mm. A tiny little bit of grit there, enough to sort of anchor you and keep you going. So, having said that, my two-word review really is, yucca yucca, because it's, pretty funny as well. So, there we go, Tower Heist. My critical reputation is flying out the open window.
Just in my opinion.
Hey, credit where credit's due.
Indeed. All right, let's move on to our final film for the show.
What's so complicated about this place?
It's a zoo.
Yay!
I like the animals, but I love the humans.
All you need is 20 seconds of insane courage. And I promise you, something great will come of it.
Kaylee, tell us about We Bought a Zoo.
Oh, We Bought a Zoo. Tearjerker.
Yeah.
Extraordinaire. Well, We Bought a Zoo is Cameron Crowe's latest film. I believe the last one he did was Elizabethtown.
Which I haven't seen. So. Okay.
I don't think I've seen all of it. It was that bad.
Right.
I think I also watched it on VHS or something. Anywho, We Bought a Zoo is actually based on a true life story of a man whose name I can't remember right now because I don't know.
Benjamin Mee,
thank you. Yes, who loses his wife and is kind of unhappy at work and very restless and trying to figure out what to do now that he's a single father, and decides to buy a rundown zoo and build it back up, and family drama ensues.
Yeah, quite major family drama because his brother tries to persuade him not to at every stage of the process.
Yes.
And it costs him an enormous amount of money to make this thing happen.
There's an incredible amount of strain between him and his son as well, which continues that subject we talked about in our Best of 2011 that
parenting.
Parenting.
Yep.
The parenting, and you know how the young, adorable child who pretty much, you know, makes the whole movie flow. Is he's, you know, she's the favorite, she's the baby, and then the son is having issues.
There's an interesting line in there about where one of the characters says that to Matt Damon's character, you know, your daughter, she reminds you of your wife, so you give her a sort of free pass, but your son reminds you of you, and so you give him a hard time.
Yes.
And I think that there's an element of that sort of psychological truth undercutting the whole thing. Mm. There's a lot of cute animals in it as well, and it is a family movie, isn't it, really?
It's definitely a family movie, yeah. And it's also a tearjerker. Like I said, Happy Feet 2 and We Bought a Zoo are competing for the, like, buckets of tears from Kaylee Carruthers.
Mm. Cameron Crowe, he is probably most famous for Jerry Maguire. Would that be fair comment? He's the guy who wrote Show Me the Money and You Had Me at Hello. And he seems to be really, really good at writing these little set pieces, little speeches for people. And there are quite a few scattered all the way through We Bought a Zoo. And they get you in spite of yourself. You know, you're thinking, this is formula, even to the extent of widower bouncing back after the death of his wife. That's a pretty familiar story. Having to start again with the kids, that's a familiar story. And the fish out of water into an unknown sort of space, that's a familiar story. And yet Cameron Crowe, there's some skill there, isn't there, in terms of how he manages to sort of keep wringing the emotion out of these familiar situations that in lesser hands you'd just be going, well, I've been there, done that, seen this, what's new about it? And he does seem to know how to push the buttons. And the ending, the timing of that ending, the selection of the scene that ends the film, you just think, wow, I've just spent 2 hours in the hands of somebody who really knows what they're doing in terms of sending you on an emotional journey. It's not brilliant filmmaking, but as an element out of the Hollywood machine, he knows what he's doing, doesn't he?
And it was an enjoyable ride, and you were definitely in the hands of a master, but you know, it still definitely has that Cameron Crowe stamp on it. You know, he has this formula and he's sticking to it, but it makes it a good film because he knows what he's doing.
I watched Say Anything again the other day because I wanted to remind myself of what Cameron Crowe...
I love that film.
I know so many people absolutely adore that film, you know.
Who doesn't want that boombox?
John Cusack, In Your Eyes, Outside the Window, but you know, Cameron Crowe has populated his films with cute kids since the very beginning, and it's exactly this. Here we are 25 years on, 23 years on since Say Anything, and he still uses a little pumpkin to keep the thing going. It's amazing, and she's cute, isn't she? She's adorable, that daughter, and it's like, I don't know where they find them, but you know, it's not advancing the Cameron Crowe auteur situation on any further, but you know that there's somebody who does know what they're doing.
Yes, I did out of the, because there's quite a good cast as well, but Patrick Fugit, I did want to see more out of him. He's
silent for most of the film,
silent,
isn't he?
Yeah. It's so sad because I really liked him. He was great in Saved, and I think he was in Chum Scrubber as well.
And he was discovered by Cameron Crowe for Almost Famous.
Yeah. And he's great, yeah. But it's like, where did you go? He looks like he's been living in a commune for the last 5 years and doesn't speak anymore, which is okay. But Patrick, come back to us, please.
And so a good cast. Scarlett Johansson, did we mention her? She's pretty good. And Dakota Fanning's sister, Elle Fanning,
played this totally weirdo mental girl. And the person I went with, we were pretty convinced that she was just playing herself.
I can't really comment on that, but I thought that it was a good performance regardless.
It was a good performance.
She was also in Super 8, wasn't she?
Yes, she was.
And she was pretty good in that too.
Very good.
And so, yeah, so that Fanning family, definitely another one to watch there. Are you going to go and see We Bought a Zoo, Symes, after our sort of...
No, it's on the slate. It's one of the ones that I have to take the kids to in the next week or two. But I must say that the audience reaction...
They might want a lion for their birthday.
Stuff, that's no problem. But the audience reactions to it's very good. So, I mean, people going to it are really enjoying it.
Yep. It's a really tough time of year, isn't it, for even a film like this to stand out amongst the crowd. We were talking before we went to air about you know, when families have got a certain amount of money to spend on the movies, they're pretty much choosing Tintin at the moment, aren't they? Mm. You know, it'd be sort of 2-1 in favour of Tintin over everything else. Would that be fair comment?
Yeah, no, I think it's spot on. It's really interesting to see big groups, big family groups coming in to see Tintin.
All right. Well, just before we go, I was looking for some music to close the show out, and I thought...
What about your two-word review?
Oh, crikey. Yeah, well done. Words. Well spotted. Okay. My two-word review is acceptably cutesy.
Oh. Mm. Mine was tearjerker. Family tearjerker.
Family tearjerker. Good use of the hyphenate.
I'm misting up now just thinking about it.
Really?
I think I might do a double bill for you and put on Happy Feet and We Bought a Zoo. You know,
I would be so dehydrated afterwards. I'd just be rolling around on the cinema floor. Oh, God. Oh.
So I was looking for some music to close the show out, and, you know, the soundtrack to We Bought a Zoo is by somebody called Jonesy.
Yes, of Sigur Rós.
Yeah, they're awesome.
Thank you for helping me with the pronunciation there. Although... if you didn't know that and you were talking about the music afterwards, all you would remember really would be all of the baby boomer hits that he drags out. So you know, there's Dylan and who else is there? Tom Petty. And, you know, so actually if you were to ask anybody who came out what was the music like, they'll go, yeah, we really like that Tom Petty song. But they won't really remember this Sigur Rós character, Jonesy. But I did quite like this music while I was listening to it this afternoon, so we'll just have a listen to this and then we'll say our goodbyes. That's a bit of Jonesy, and the song's called Gathering Stories from the soundtrack of We Bought a Zoo. And I thought it was an interesting choice of person to produce a soundtrack for a big Hollywood movie, somebody from Iceland, esoteric avant-garde composer like that. And, you know, the music was all right, but I think it'd probably stand up much better actually listening to it outside the context of the film.
But it's like Jonesy's and Sigur Rós's music respectively is the very emotional, and that I think it definitely really played into the emotionality of it.
Do you think that was a trigger for you?
I think so. Even if you listen to...
Do we need to turn it off now or we're going to lose you?
That's okay. But you can... I'm just... They use similar music for the Olympics in Vancouver, and it's just like, oh, no.
Next week on the show, we are going to deduce whether Sherlock Holmes, A Game of Shadows, is worth pursuing. We're going to pin a tail on a dolphin. And Mia, can somebody help me?
Wasikowska.
With Wasikowska from Albert Nobbs. She's going to get yet another starring role, this time in a film called Restless. And we'll be looking ahead at 2012 and seeing what different people's expectations are for the cinema year in 2012, not just us. If you've enjoyed this episode, don't forget to click subscribe in iTunes or your own favourite podcasting software. I was trying out a few different non-iTunes podcast programs, and there are lots of different choices out there. If you have an Apple sort of... If you're an anti-Apple person, you don't have to use Apple to listen to Cinematica. But if you subscribe in whatever software you choose, the latest episode is always downloaded automatically, which we love. Please leave us feedback at the iTunes store or on the website. Ratings, reviews, etc. They're all really useful to us. You can contact us via Twitter.
At CinematicaCast.
Facebook.
Facebook.com/CinematicaPodcast.
She's not even referring to notes, ladies and gentlemen. And at our website...
www.cinematica.co.nz.
And this show is executive produced by Simon Wherry, produced, engineered and edited by me, Dan Slevin. The news editor and weather girl is Kaylee Carruthers. The theme music from the beginning of the show is 6x6 by Earl Van Dyke. You can buy it at the iTunes store. We're leaving you with Jonesy and Gathering Stories. That's good night from me, Dan Slevin.
And it's good night from me, Simon.
Au revoir from me, Kaylee Carruthers.
See you next week. and a little bit earlier next time, because we'll be back to Tuesdays as of next week. So have a great week, everybody.